Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. In the new Broadway play, American Son, two parents find themselves at a Florida police station in the middle of the night searching for their missing son. And all they know at first is that their son's car is, quote, in the system. It's a parent's worst nightmare. And adding to their fear is the fact that their son is about 18, about 6 feet tall, and a mixed-race kid who no one can seem to locate after a late-night traffic stop. American Son opens November 4th at the Booth Theater. It's directed by Tony winner Kenny Leon, whose previous shows include Children of a Lesser God and A Raisin in the Sun, and it stars Kerry Washington and Stephen Pasquale as the distraught parents. Stephen Pasquale and Kenny Leon are in studio. Thanks for coming down, guys.
Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween
That's
to
right,
you.
Happy Halloween.
So let me set the stage for folks who haven't read about the play. Kendra and Scott are this estranged couple. They disagree over how to best raise their son. He's 18 years old. They're brought together in the middle of the night at this police station while officers try to track down their son, Jamal. Mom gets there first. So, Kenny, when you first sit in the theater, you hear rain sounds before the lights even go down.
You actually see rain as well.
You see it a little, and then this curtain comes up, and Kendra, is sitting there, and she doesn't talk for a while. Mm-hmm. It's just this sort of silence, but there's so much telegraphed in the silence. So tell me a little bit about working with an actor where the first thing he or she has to do is not talk.
I actually think it helps us here because, Kerry has a huge following. And I think that moment when the character has a chance to distance herself from what people think she is, I think actually helps the show.
Oh, that's interesting.
So to come up in silence, and it's great for us. And I think Kendra, it teaches the audience in that moment, this is how it's going to be. It's real time, it's real seconds, it's real moments. And if this were your kid, how would you respond?
And from the jump, we see how this husband and wife, they're estranged, but we see how, so their race differences and class differences, mm-hmm. how that affects their assumptions and their thoughts about how their son's going to be treated. So Scott comes in, mm-hmm. he's an FBI agent, we see the badge. Mm-hmm. So how did that approach
Did you see the show?
I did.
Oh, okay.
So the way that
you know a lot about it.
So how does that approach the way you create him physically, how you create what he's going to bring to this crisis?
Well, it's interesting. Kerry and I talked a lot about the type of couple that these people are, and you know, we live in New York in an artist community where everyone is doing their best to get to therapy every week and talk about their issues properly and blah blah blah. And these are not people like that. Mm-hmm. So you know, we like to make the assumption that they're some couples counseling and some therapy away from being able to articulate themselves better and have things work out between the two of them better than in this play. But he's a real stiff upper lip, sort of a lawman type, kind of an old school dad who feels like he absolutely understands right and wrong. But he's crazy about this woman, and they've created this family together, and they have an enormous love and history. But the challenges in the difference between a white father and a black mother and how you parent a mixed race son, we believe is really the crux of the sort of why the marriage is really struggling at this point and the heart of the play, really.
Mm-hmm. Some of the things that are interesting is Kendra is a psychology professor and a PhD, and she corrects her husband's grammar throughout the play. And there is that sort of that interesting, subtle educational class difference going on. Kenny, when you were trying to figure out how to show the audience that these two people came from different worlds, what kind of conversations did you have?
Well, as a director, I'm never trying to show the audience. I'm always trying to engage the audience. And I think Christopher Demos Brown has written a wonderful play that allows the audience to look at America through four different lenses. And you know, have four people on stage, many times they disagree about a lot. But if you're in that audience, you say, I thought I disagreed with that, but I hear what that person is saying. And that's the beautiful thing about this play. So I'm hoping at the end of those 90 minutes, those emotionally filled 90 minutes, that the audience will walk away and say, you know what? I want to go home and think about this. I want to go to a coffee shop and talk about this. I want to talk about what's good for the country, what's good for family, what's good for our future. And that's what I think Christopher has done an amazing job at, just really presenting a sort of a dream about America and how we would like it to be.
Mm-hmm. The two other actors, one plays a sort of dim-witted, latently racist police officer, and the other one's a black cop who's an up from the bootstraps kind of by the by book person. And it's interesting because nobody's entirely right and nobody's entirely wrong in this play.
That's right. You know, we like to say that you tend to agree with the last person that talked in the play.
That's why I would not call that person a dimwit. I would call it a person just maybe not as red as some other people, but he has a point of view and a way of looking at the world, and even that person has something to say.
Oh, he's still dim.
Yeah.
He's a little dim.
No, that's what you think. That's what you think.
Okay. Fair point. Fair point.
But it's a lot of comedy in the show as well.
Yeah, and that's interesting.
Because of the situation of the event, of the night.
With it being so such a difficult subject, how did you both balance the comedic elements?
Well, what's smart about the writing is the audience has a really great time for the first probably 30 minutes of the evening. It's a great way to sort of loosen everybody up and get to know these people before the evening kind of takes a more serious turn. So it's a great, like, kind of ice-breaking way into the story, what Chris has done with that, with the writing off the top.
And what we always say is let the story happen, not make it happen. So great comedy is inherent in the writing. So it's just the situations of what they're talking about, you find humor in that. But no one is trying to make you laugh. It's just, there's some comedy in being in a police station at 4 a.m. and when someone doesn't understand what you're saying.
We're speaking with Kenny Leon, who directed American Son, and Stephen Pasquale, who stars in it. Your character, Scott, goes through this incredible evolution in these 90 minutes.
That's so true.
I mean, he seems to ultimately, I won't give him away, starts to understand what powerlessness means.
Well, Scott's journey in the play is fascinating to me. He enters the room, as he does every room, with his absolute air of command and privilege as not just a straight white male, but a member of the law enforcement community, right? And through the course of the evening, he is entirely stripped of his power through the perception of being the dad to a black son. And that is a devastating journey to take every night. And I got to thank Carrie for making that actual, for noticing that a few weeks ago. I remember she said, "Boy, watching you go from complete power to no power is one of the tricks of why the play is so good."
You've had to deal with a situation like this before because you played Mark Furman in The People versus O.J.
Yeah. Well, Mark Furman is a flaming racist, right? Yeah. So the difference is big in that Scott is not. He just has a very, very complicated and simple and doesn't quite understand, you know, his wife's desire to allow their son to explore his blackness. Mm-hmm. He doesn't understand it on a level that would be healthy, but certainly doesn't operate on a Mark Furman level, which is a deep and ignorant bias.
But I follow you on Twitter, so I know your politics.
Yeah, I got to keep Steve out of Scott.
Yeah. Absolutely. something I, you know, back to our idea of comedy a little bit is, you know, the audience when I saw it was a third black. Mm-hmm. And quite often our people talk back to the stage, and there's a lot of talking in the audience and reacting, and are people recognizing language that their grandmother used? Or did you account for that? Did you have to adjust for that at all? Did you?
We always
knew,
account for
we
that.
We knew it was going to happen.
We always, you know, I mean, anytime you have people that look different sitting next to each other, then they create something that neither community had. And it's a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. And I always tell actors, you know, we can't control how someone responds to it. But one thing we've been talking about as actors on stage is like, okay, make sure that they understand that we are driving the rhythm and the tempo. So there's a way to sort of teach the audience as the play begins, and a way you give them room to respond, but then come right in right away. So it's actually a fun time at the booth in terms of the audience and their relationship to what's on stage. It's very exciting.
It's a great experiment, too, in like allowing the audience, particularly this diverse crowd who comes to see the play, to have their response. But if we let them, it would just go on and on and on. So we really got to jump back in and say, if you keep it up, you're going to miss the next moment. So you can like have your laugh or your or whatever's happening. But, you know, we got to keep going.
And one of the most rewarding things for me as a director and being in this Broadway community for a while is to know that American Son can sit next to The Ferryman or sit next to Dear Evan Hansen or Hamilton. Mm-hmm. It fits in at a more diversity of storytelling that we have on our Broadway stages and through our regional theaters across the country, the better we are. And so it feels good to see that American Son belongs and that young people like 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds are in the audience every night, 80-year-olds are in the audience every night, and they all say, live theater is great. Mm-hmm. And to hear that and to see that and dealing with a serious topic is very rewarding as a director.
It's also good for producers to see.
Absolutely.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
Some more things will get made like
that's
this.
Right. That's
We're talking
right.
to Steve Pasquale and Kenny Leon about American Son. You alluded to it earlier, you said it earlier, that the play is 90 minutes, it's real time, and it's one space. Mm-hmm. The two other rooms are for our imagination, the
yes.
where to get
mm-hmm.
the water fountain and where the guy goes and gets coffee. What are some of the challenges of one space, and what are some of the benefits of one space?
Wow.
Well, you only got those actors.
You, got,
you don't
you
have
got,
a lot of help.
You need four great actors, and I think with Kerry Washington and Stephen Pasquale and Eugene Lee and Jeremy Jordan, that's the first step. And then the second step is to get all of them on the same page and to see them have the same tone and understand how the play works. And for me, or for us as a team, we got to keep it moving. We earn our pauses. So there may be three big pauses in the play, but that means we can't put pauses in other places. You know, mm-hmm. so we have to keep it moving visually. I have to keep it moving so the audience is engaged with it and leaning forward in their seats. And so far, we've been lucky.
Yeah. It's a fine line between the audience getting ahead of a play and feeling like they want to, they're sort of breathlessly watching it and catching up. And we want to always, you know, stay ahead of them. And so that I feel like that allows the sort of one space to have a lot of energy and dynamics, et cetera.
I also think one thing is important, at least in American theater, you have producers like Jeffrey Richards who really sets out to find great new American plays and mm-hmm. to discover that new writer out there who's not getting produced. So my hat's off to Jeffrey Richards, and also for him engaging other producers who haven't produced on in this atmosphere, mm-hmm. like Kerry Washington and mm-hmm. Shonda Rhimes and mm-hmm. and Gabrielle Union. So it's a good thing.
The playwright is an attorney who worked in Miami, for people who don't know. And
a full-time practicing prosecutor. He yeah. writes plays at night. Isn't that incredible? We want this play to do well enough that he can pack up that law office and come to New York.
Right.
Well, he said that he was prompted because he saw so many young men in the system at the end of the night being at the hands of police violence or brutality in some way, and he just felt like he needed to express it. And I'm interested in what it's like to be in a play like this, knowing that you could turn on the news tonight and see that story.
Well, I mean, the reason I wanted to do the play is because it feels like an important piece of writing to hold a mirror up to society in the current disaster of a administration. I think that these are conversations we have to have, and you know, serious writing by serious writers about a serious topic doesn't happen so much on Broadway anymore. So it felt doubly important to me to sort of have the conversation be had.
Absolutely. And I think I'm thankful that we say Tamir Rice in a play on a raid stage in front of the community, you know, so forever those names of those young men that yeah. have lost their lives.
Philando Castile.
It's in our art forever, and American Son has done that. Yeah.
Yeah, they memorialize those names. That's a beautiful thing about the play.
Yeah.
The other thing is the play is also a love story.
Yes.
You know, it really, and how do you keep the love story sort of engaging and alive when we're talking about these big, heavy, serious topics? But there's also this couple who are just in this
were you rooting for
funky
them?
Place.
Were you rooting for them when you were watching the play? That's sort of what we're hoping for.
A little bit. I just say that.
Past their stuff, you know what I mean?
The woman next to me just leaned over and goes, she's exhausting about Carrie's character.
Hey, I think you would be pretty exhausting at 4 in the morning
yeah, right.
in a police station yeah. and you can't find your kid.
But for a husband, too. She's always
oh,
up
right.
here,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, well, she, you know, she wears her intellect on her sleeve and she's fiercely successful, well-educated, knows what she's talking about. I think the important thing is that the play doesn't work if the couple doesn't have a deep and historic love. And that's why I think Kenny and Kerry are absolutely the right people to make this play happen too, because it's people root for them despite this divide that they can't seem to cross.
And what I love about it is that I always say, all you have is now. You know, great acting takes place in the moment. So the play can't be about what happens in the second half of the play or what happens at the end of the play. Along that journey, what happens? Is it engaging? Is it interesting? That's why there's room for humor. If you know in your own life, if you go to the hospital, the last thing you want to talk about is like who's sick or injured. You try to talk about everything but, you know, the elephant in the room. And so that's what happens in this story. You get to explore their love and their marriage and their understanding about the country and diversity and race and education. You get to understand, see all of that along the way. And all of that is universal.
We're speaking with Steve Pasquale and Kenny Leon. Kenny directed American Son, and Steve is starring it. It's on Broadway. It is opening November 4th at the Booth Theater. Okay, in the New York Times, Kenny, you described yourself as, quote, a pretty pushy director.
Did I say that?
Yeah, you did.
Put it this way. He has a philosophy that if you're late, everybody does push-ups.
The funny part about I asked you the question, but Steve answered.
Talk about pushy. No, he's the greatest.
I think I'm just, I'm committed to finding the truth. And I find out that a lot of actors stand next to truth or beside truth, but never in truth. And I'm just demanding that we stand in the truth of what's on those pages. And I have four wonderful actors who are committed to that every night.
Carrie, in a profile, also said that this has been a really challenging role for her. How about for you?
It's super challenging. Mm-hmm. But I got to give credit where credit is due. The journey that Carrie takes in the play is really taxing. And she's giving a master class in how to do that every night. Mm-hmm. But I'm very fond of Scott and Kendra both. I think that relationship is a real snapshot of America. In a nutshell.
If we don't believe they have been married for 20 years, then the play doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. There's so much to take in. Somebody asked me, oh, how's the play? And I went, whew, right?
Yeah,
there's just a lot to take in. And there's a guide, if you go on the website for folks, if you're going to go check this out, that's sort of a, how would you describe it? Is it an educational guide? Is it with the opportunity agenda? Is it something to help people process the information?
Action guide.
Yeah.
Yeah, to give people tools to talk about this delicate subject, race in America, identity in America, how we police our communities of color, what it's like to be a mixed race person in this country.
What is it like to be a 17-year-old and your parents are going through a divorce?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right, sure.
There's a big part of that.
Yeah.
Before I let you guys go, what are you doing next, Kenny? I know you're deep in it, but what's next?
I'm doing a new play at Yale Repertory Theater called Good Faith. And it deals with diversity in the ranks of firefighters.
Firefighters?
Amazing. Yeah.
By the way, you will always have a place in my heart as White Sean.
Okay,
Rescue Me.
I'm so glad about that. Thank you.
And will we hear you sing again? For people who don't know, Steve Pasquale has one of the most beautiful voices you've ever.
Oh, you're
ever.
So nice.
I'm not nice, I'm just accurate.
No, I've got two musicals in the hopper. So one will happen, I think, next season, and then one probably season after that. So we'll be singing for a little while after this.
All right.
I get back in there to work with the great Steve Pasquale?
Whenever you want, man. Whenever you want. Whenever you want. We'll always find a slot for you, man.
Oh, good. This means it was a good experience.
Absolutely.
I hope you both come back when your projects are up and running.
Thank you for having us.
It was a pleasure to meet you.
Yeah,
Steve Pasquale and Kenny Leon. The name of the play is American Son. It opens November 4th at the Booth Theater. Everybody, 6 days till the midterms. Next up, we check in with some local ballot measures with WNYC's planning editor, Kate Hines, and our weekly installment called Living Here with Kate. All of it will be back after a quick break. Welcome back. I'm Allison Stewart, and you're listening to All of It. It's time for this week's installment of Living Here with Kate, where we're joined by WNYC's planning editor, Kate Hines, to find out what's popping in the local news plan for the week. Hi, welcome back, Kate.
Thank you very much.
All right, midterms. What do you have for us?
I have our ballot questions, the New York City ballot questions. We have three. They're going to be on our ballot next Tuesday. Again, this is only for New York City residents, five boroughs. Before I get to the ballot questions, which involve Charter Commission, I just want to back up and explain a little bit about what the city charter is. It provides the structure for New York City government to get things done. It's like the city constitution.
Okay.
It outlines the roles and responsibilities of city agencies and officials and what kind of power they have. The last time the city charter was overhauled in a major way was in 1989, which you may remember got rid of the city's Board of Estimate, and that was a huge deal.
Frankly, I didn't remember that, but I know it's a big deal. So
how can you not remember that? People got like tattoos for the Board of Estimate.
I was 23 and probably at Palladium, that's why, but go ahead.
So that was 30 years ago. Now we have not one, but two competing charter review commissions happening. The questions that are going to be on the ballot next Tuesday were put together by Mayor de Blasio's City Charter Review Commission, and it's limited mostly to civic engagement questions. I'm going to run through the three right now. I'll get to the second Charter Review Commission in a second, which is City Council. Okay. Won't be on the ballot till next year, so don't worry about it. Only focus on these three questions. Question number one, campaign finance. If you vote yes, it will lower the amount of money a candidate may accept from a contributor and increase public matching funds and make those funds available earlier. So, you know, this is a pretty technical question. It's trying to lower the bar for people to get into to run a campaign, the amount of money that they have to spend. It would reduce maximum contributions to citywide races from individual contributors. The current limit now is $5,100, would drop it to about $2,000. A lot of people like this. A lot of people don't. They say it really only affects candidates who apply for matching funds. So if you are a self-funded candidate, if you're a millionaire, this doesn't affect you at all. Right. You really don't care.
Right. The second one, is that the Civic Engagement Commission?
It is. And a yes vote for that would create a citywide participatory budgeting program, expand language access at polling sites. The mayor says this is really designed to get more New Yorkers involved in their community organizations and get people to the polls and vote. Opponents say this is yet another city agency, it's another piece of bureaucracy, and one that will almost certainly be politicized because the mayor would have a lot of power over who gets appointed to this commission in the first place.
So that one sounds more distinctly left and right.
Right. Although these first two are not that controversial.
Okay.
Like, most people are like, yeah, one and two, you know, okay, I can see the merits of them. It's not until things get, question three is when things get nuclear.
Okay. When it gets messy about community boards.
Oh, my. Anytime you mention community boards. The third would impose term limits on community board members and change how they're appointed and recruited.
Oh, the T word, term limit.
Oh, my gosh. Like, anything involving community boards is going to be controversial. And this is, of course, the most controversial measure, which is no surprise at all. So if approved, this measure limits board members to four consecutive two-year terms. Members could be reappointed after taking a term off. It would also require borough presidents to have to seek diverse appointments and report on how representative their community boards are of the neighborhoods they serve. And it would be phased in. This is not something that happens overnight. The big knock on this, and I just want to say beforehand that, you know, we've had some great reporting done on this. Carl Boisrond, who's in the WNYC newsroom, has done a lot of good stuff on community boards. Jessica Gould had a whole explainer on this morning, so I urge people to listen to that. But to boil it down, there are a lot of community board members who have been in place for a very long time. I believe there's someone sitting on the zoning board for this area here, the community board for about 50 years or something like that. I mean, the longest serving community board member in New York City. These people, a lot of them get into office and they remain there. Now, a lot of borough presidents, and I think four of the five borough presidents don't like this and plan to vote no for this one, say that it takes a long time to obtain the type of expertise you need to really have a say in things like land use and development and zoning. You know, these are big thorny issues that you're asking members of the public to really get involved in.
And but on the other hand, other people are saying, we can't have career community board members.
Exactly. And a lot of people believe that you really have to diversify community boards, not just from a race point of view, but from an age point of view. There's a lot of people sitting in community boards that have been in there a long time. And speaking from my own personal experience, whenever I go to my community board meeting, it's a lot of the first like half an hour is establishing of the bona fides, where community board members say things like, I've lived on this, you know, on the Upper West Side for 60 years. And, you know, we've always done it this way. And that's a little bit of a caricature and maybe slightly unfair, but it's not that far off the mark.
Yeah. All right. What about people from my home state of Jersey?
You only got one ballot question,
I'll
New Jersey. If voters, do you want to approve the state borrowing $500 million to pay for a series of public school projects? If it's okay, the money would go towards improving security at K through 12 schools, upgrading water infrastructure to protect students from lead. This is a big issue right now. And expanding vocational and county college programs. It has a lot of support in the legislature, including from both sides of the aisle, both parties. It's been endorsed by a lot of people. But a lot of other people are saying, wait a minute. How is this bond issue going to impact the state's already extremely significant debt burden, especially as more than $1 billion in new borrowing has been authorized in recent months by the New Jersey legislature without any voter approval?
Wow. So that one started out vanilla and got chocolate chips and some marshmallow and some Heath bar thrown in. That got complicated towards the end.
It sure did.
Huh. That's why we like having you in. Living here with Kate. Kate Hines, WNYC's planning editor. Thanks for swinging by.
Thank you.
Happy Halloween, everybody. You know, the Thompson Square Dog Park Halloween Parade has been a New York tradition for nearly 30 years. But you know what? This year, it almost didn't happen. There were issues with insurance, with funds. Hey, it's New York. Somebody's always got issues. But in true New Yorker fashion, a bunch of folks got together to find a solution. It's a story our colleagues at The Gothamist have been following intently. Jen Carlson, editorial director of The Gothamist, covered this story, and she joins me here. Hi, Jen.
Hi, Allison.
So why was this event originally going to be canceled?
So basically, the Parks Department said that they needed an insurance policy this year because the parade has grown so much. So they were expecting like 18,000 people, I think, and Tompkins Square Park is a very small area. So it was like they're going to need volunteers. They're going to need this insurance thing. They couldn't afford it. So they said they were canceling it.
So why in people's minds is this sort of sweet neighborhoody mom and pop thing? It has become a real attraction, it sounds like. Mm-hmm. And that the Parks Department said this could be an issue, right? Mm-hmm. So, okay, so up until now, was there an organization running the parade or was it just sort of organic?
It was just sort of volunteers who used the park with their dogs. And I think there had been like a couple people who informally kind of ran the parade.
So there's one person I know who's really invested in this, Garrett Rosso.
Mm-hmm.
Who is that?
He actually, I don't think, was involved this year. He was the one who was kind of doing it before. Mm-hmm. And then he was the one who made the announcement that, you know, we're not going to do it this year. And then another volunteer that he had been working with, Ada Nieves, came in and took over.
So people do not like to have their Halloween stuff taken away from them. What happened once people found out that the dog parade was going to be? Because it is funny. I'm sort of smiling about it. It's a big deal. People love to go to that parade.
Yeah, it's a very nice thing that we have to look forward to. And so, you know, someone came in with a GoFundMe to help do that. And then eventually this grassroots organization in the Lower East Side came in. And they took on the insurance sort of like burden.
Who was it? Do you remember their name?
Goals.
Goals?
It's a good old Lower East Side it stands for.
It's a perfect name, right? Did they actually, because of the size, did they have to change venue?
Yeah, they changed it to the East River Amphitheater. Not too far away, but, you know, it kind of took away from the neighborhood feel. But people apparently loved it. So they might even stay there next year. Who knows?
True or not, I don't know if the internet lies or tells the truth. Was ESPN covering it?
Yes, they donated $10,000 and they had one of, I think, their new people come in, Katie Nolan, to MC it.
Oh my gosh. So do we know what the numbers were? It happened this past Sunday.
Mm-hmm. I haven't seen any official numbers. They were expecting around 18,000.
Wow. Where they give away prizes. Can you tell us, did you get to go?
I didn't go. We had a photographer go out there.
What were some of the best costumes?
I think, oh gosh, I don't even know who won.
I saw Ruth Bader Ginsburg pug.
There were a few.
That was one.
Yeah, there were a few of those. There were a lot of like popes. There was a lot of superhero dogs. Dogs dressed as food is very popular. There was a cat that was just a cat.
And an Andy Warhol. Yeah. But I think the cat is just a cat. Yeah. Can we see some of those photos at the Gothamist?
They are up there.
All right. I'm not dressing up. I have a dog for the first time this year. I'm not doing it, but the pictures are really, really cute. Jen from The Gothamist, Jen Carlson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up next in All of It, we're talking about the life of the upcoming criminal trial of the drug kingpin El Chapo. A new bilingual documentary podcast from Vice tells the story of El Chapo within the broader context of the decades-long international drug war. Don't go away. All of It will be right back. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Joaquin El Chapo Guzman Loera was head of one of the largest, most powerful, and most brutal cartels in Mexico, the Sinaloa Drug Cartel. Over the years, he has captured the attention of the world and gained mythological status as an escape artist when he twice got out of top security prisons and eluded police. In 2016, he was finally caught by Mexican Marines and extradited to the United States. U.S. officials have said he is responsible for, quote, the death and destruction of millions of lives across the globe through drug addiction, violence, and corruption. El Chapo is now awaiting trial next week in New York's Metropolitan Correctional Center. Yesterday, his attorneys lost a last-minute bid to postpone the trial to review evidence. There is now a new long-form bilingual documentary podcast from Vice News called Chapo, Kingpin on Trial. Its co-host Keegan Hamilton joins me now in studio. Hi, Keegan.
Hello.
He is the U.S. editor at Vice News, covering drug policy, immigration, and criminal justice. And I believe on the phone we have Miguel.
Hello, yeah, this is Miguel.
Hi, we have Miguel Angel Vega, a top narco journalist from Rio Dice, 12. He's a filmmaker and fixer. The series tells the story of El Chapo, and let's dive into it. So, Keegan, last week on a tweet, you said El Chapo's case is about more than just his guilt or innocence. It's about the entire war on drugs and the countless lives it has impacted on both sides of the border. With this in mind, what is the goal of the podcast?
I think it's absolutely to tell the story of the people whose lives have been affected by not just El Chapo and his rise and fall, but also the response from the Mexican and U.S. governments. So, you know, it's easy to focus on this one person and the crimes that he's committed, but we wanted to look at the bigger picture and talk about, you know, sort of the collateral damage that was done over the years in the efforts to capture him and bring him to justice.
Miguel, El Chapo means shorty. It was his nickname. He's about 5'7". He has other nicknames like El Rabido for the fast one, for the ability to move shipments. So Miguel Angel, can you explain to people his folk icon status? Why people in villages, you know, last week, they were praising him for receiving mattresses and stoves after a hurricane.
Oh, yeah. People in Culiacan love El Chapo because many people feel he's like the anti-hero of Mexico. And other people believe he helps people in the mountains where he was born and also in Culiacan. So there's this whole mythology about El Chapo that we were just trying to unveil.
So, Keegan, in the first episode, it's called The Fixer. You travel to Mexico, you meet up with Miguel Angel. Now, fixers are really important, everybody knows. Whenever you go to another country, you have somebody on the ground who knows the ins and outs, the ways. Why was it particularly important to have a fixer for this series?
I mean, when you go to a place like Culiacan in Sinaloa, and especially out into the rural parts of Sinaloa, if you don't know people there, you're not going to get anywhere. And it's quite dangerous to go if you don't have somebody with local connections who has, you know, told contacts in the community that you're coming and that you want to speak with them. So having somebody like Miguel Angel, who's been doing that for years, knows tons of people, has contacts in that world, it's essential. You can't just parachute into that world.
Hi, guys, we're here.
Yeah, talk to us, please. Tell us about the drugs. It's not going to work. So having a Miguel Angel is critical. I mean, I think a lot of people view foreign journalists as just being able to go and do that work. But fixers are the unsung heroes of the journalism world who make other people's work possible.
Miguel Angel, when you got a call to be a fixer and you hear the stories about El Chapo, what did you think?
Well, it's another story, but taking what Keegan was saying, the minute this guy, Kate and Keegan, landed in Culiacan, I told them, welcome to Culiacan, I'm going to be your own personal Jesus. So they laughed to death. But, you know, Keegan is right. People need a connection, needs like an inside man that knows not just the place and all the security issues, but also can get them access to whatever they need to see. In this case, they wanted to go to La Tuna, which is the home the town where El Chapo was born. And I knew that was kind of risky because a few months ago there was a war going on in the mountains. So I need to, you know, ask my connections, you know, I'm going over there and it is safe for us to go there. And they told me, well, right now it's okay, but you know, you might be stopped on the way to La Tuna and something that did actually happen. And no, but everything is good. I mean, I enjoy my time a whole bunch working with Keegan and Kate. It was so fun.
So Keegan, you do touch on how, and how Dennis Miguel Angel just said, how dangerous it is and how the dangers of journalists are being killed in Mexico. What safety measures did you take while you were reporting? And have you thought about any since?
I mean, when Miguel Angel says that he's our personal Jesus, I mean, that he's joking in a way, but
not really.
In another sense, our lives are in his hands. We're trusting him when he says that it's safe to go here, that, you know, if you say so, we're going to go. So that's our precaution. Of course, we have folks' advice who specialize in making sure that we're taking all the necessary precautions. You know, we're sending people to Yemen and to Syria and those types of places. So we go through the sort of the same protocol that those reporters are going through as where are you going? Do you have who do you know there? All those sorts of precautions that you just sort of talk through, and it's a calculated risk every time you do one of those assignments.
Miguel Angel, the drug cartel, the Sinaloa drug cartel, is the largest in the world. Did the cartel know that you all were there and what you were doing, and did you get sort of a quote-unquote blessing, so to speak?
Yeah, well, obviously they knew we were going to La Tuna. They knew that we were in Culiacán. The cartel, they have these people from the airline that give them like a daily report about the people, about all the passengers that are landing in Culiacán. So I'm sure they knew Keegan and Kate were in Culiacán. So I wasn't surprised, like, you know, because these people are very much care about security. They believe that they're going to be caught any minute. They believe that undercover DEA agents are in Culiacán. So they have all these leads, and they basically check them out. And what I knew, it's like, you know, the only fear is like you could be potential undercover. But let's make sure, you know, to tell them that you are a journalist. If you're a journalist, we're going to be safe. So that's like my biggest plan when journalists come to Culiacán, make sure that the cartel knows we are real journalist.
So it's good for them in a way to know that you're there. You're on their turf.
I mean, when we go up into the mountains of Chapo's hometown, we stand out like sore thumbs. There's no concealing our presence there, nor would we want to do that. Mm-hmm. We want to be transparent that we're there to tell a story and to get their side of that story. And I think we were transparent about that, and that's why we were successful in getting the interviews that we got.
We're speaking with Keegan Hamilton. He's the co-host of the new podcast, Chapo Kingpin on Trail, and Miguel Angel Vega, who's a journalist from Mexico, who is also a part of the podcast and was their fixer in Mexico. So I do want to say that in the first episode, you guys addressed Vice News's sort of stereotype as you guys, these extreme first-person travel-to-risk journalists. We're in here providing POV no one else can. Let me play a little bit of a clip.
We get it. The Chapo beat is peak Vice. People have literally made fun of us for this exact type of thing. Maybe you've seen it. It's this Fred Armisen and Bill Hader spoof called Drones with a Z.
And no group of filmmakers risk more than those at Drones, a consortium of participant journalists whose motto is balls to the walls.
Basically, it's supposed to be two Vice reporters running around Mexico looking for a fictional drug lord called El Chingon.
The drug game is headed by the Salvez cartel, which is run by this man, El Chingon.
We don't want to be a parody of ourselves while we're here, but one of the first things we asked Miguel Angel to do is introduce us to a heroin trafficker.
Two questions. Why was that important to include? And then who did you get introduced to?
On the first question, it's important to address that is a stereotype that's out there, and to disarm that and say, look, we know that this is the perception, and we're wary of that, and we're going to not be a parody of ourselves. Mm-hmm. We do have to go to a dangerous place to do this story. We are chasing the story of the world's most notorious drug lord, but we want to do it in a way that's smart and culturally aware. To the second question, we did interview a guy who is sort of a mid-level heroin trafficker who does business with the Sinaloa cartel. And the reason that we wanted to speak with him is that's a voice you don't hear very often, is, you know, who is the person who's sending drugs to the United States? That's sort of a faceless boogeyman that U.S. law enforcement talks about a lot. Mm-hmm. So talking to that person and understanding what their motivations are, how their business works, we feel is important to understand and explain to American audiences.
What kind of conversations did you guys have within Vice about racial stereotypes, not feeding into certain stereotypes, not creating caricatures, going into Mexico?
I mean, that was definitely a conversation that we had with our producers. And we were, you know, part of it is language, being cognizant of how you're describing people, the terms that are used. We tried pretty hard to avoid words like drug lord that sort of evoke a certain image of El Chapo in particular, and just say like a drug trafficker. This is a businessman whose business happens to be drugs. Also in that, when we came back and we had so much good tape in Spanish, we wanted to find a way to get that out there and do a Spanish version of the show so that listeners whose primary language is Spanish can hear those people talking in their own words and not have the translation dubbed over it.
I want to talk about episode 2, The Legend. Miguel Angel, you managed to get these guys up to where El Chapo's mom lives. Can you describe La Tuna and what the Golden Triangle is, that area?
Well,
did we lose you?
Triangle, it's where all these the three estates of Mexico, three Mexican states, Chihuahua, Sinaloa, Verge, and it's a region that is difficult to access because of the roads.
It's difficult to access because of the roads.
And La Tuna, it's a village maybe like 50 houses there, like 50 families living there, and people like are friendly, but you can tell they are very used to see guns, and not just handguns but machine guns, all the most powerful gun guns you can imagine. So but you know, people are nice in La Sierra. You can tell they are hardworking people. Not all of them are narcos. Not all of them grow poppy or marijuana, but you can tell that's the business that they do there.
And part of the story is there's something completely mundane happening when you guys get there. There's a birthday party.
Right, and not just anybody's birthday party, but the brother of El Chapo, who has, you know, taken over a faction of the Sinaloa cartel. So there's a ton of activity in this town in terms of gunmen being everywhere. There's like a lot of security because of this party that's going on at El Chapo's mother's house, which is just sort of, you know, 50 yards away from where we're staying. So we weren't invited to this party, but we watched from afar as this celebration unfolded in front of us, which was not something we expected to see when we went there.
That's what journalism is, right? let's take a listen to that, a little bit from that second episode, The Legend.
You guys really wanted to go to that party, huh?
I mean, it would have been a bad idea for various reasons, but yeah, obviously we really wanted to go.
Well, didn't happen, bro. Sorry.
So instead, we thank them for their time, and as they're leaving, Bernarda offers, or rather insists, on sending food from the party down to us.
Actually, we should go back to the house.
Yeah.
So Miguel Angel, you sort of usher them back to the house. Why is that?
Well, I knew they felt uncomfortable because we were there, and my instincts was like, let's go back to the house, because I can tell our host Chuma was also like eager to let's go back to the house, because there were many people all over the place, and you can see they all are armed. And the sister was like, oh, yeah, I'll think about taking you to the party, but I knew it wasn't happening.
Why are you laughing, Keegan?
I mean, the people in the Sierra are so polite that they would never say no, like, sorry, mm-hmm. we're not going to invite you. So it's all, we'll think about it. We'll get our hopes up a little bit, when really Miguel Angel knows the whole time that it ain't going to happen.
We're talking to Keegan Hamilton, co-host of Vice News' podcast, Chapo Kingpin on the Trail, and Miguel Angel Vega, who is calling in from, he was their fixer in Mexico and is a journalist in Mexico. Something that I think it's interesting, and I think you're going to cover in the podcast, please correct me if I'm wrong, is that you're going to talk a little bit about the effect of El Chapo and the drug trade on both sides of the border. For example, El Chapo is considered a public enemy in Chicago. Why is that, and why is that important to think about and to include in this podcast?
Absolutely. I mean, he was named public enemy number one in Chicago a few years back. He was the first person to earn that title since Al Capone. The Sinaloa cartel is known to have a large presence and be the main supplier of drugs in Chicago and throughout the Midwest. That's Public Enemy Number One is sort of a, it's not a real thing. It's a thing that law enforcement, a title that law enforcement slaps on someone to get attention, mm-hmm. to say, oh, we want to, the people to know who this is so that we can put the
a information. Signifier.
Exactly. But we also, we went to Chicago and talked to drug traffickers there to understand, you know, all right, so this guy's captured, he's out of the picture. What has changed for you? And the answer is nothing. I mean, business continues as usual. So that, I think our takeaway from that is we should question, you know, what's the point? Is it really worth bringing this guy to the United States to stand trial? And you can, there's two sides to that question. And we don't, I don't think, you know, have an answer to it, but it's certainly something that we want people to think about as they listen to the show.
Miguel Angel, is there a sense that it's more of a horizontal kind of across the cartel, the power source, rather than just El Chapo, the one guy at the top?
You know, ever since El Chapo was arrested and extradited to the U.S., nothing has changed, not even a bit, nothing. Mm-hmm. And this is something we talked about many times. El Chapo is the figure of El Chapo is inflated. You can tell that because nothing. I mean, things got even worse. Like in Culiacán, after the extradition of El Chapo, there was this war, huge war going on, and many people died. And among those people that died was a colleague of mine, Javier Valdez. And this is because they were like chasing El Chapo, going after El Chapo for so many months, so many years. And then he was gone, and things just got worse. And like Keegan was saying, nothing has changed in the U.S. On the contrary, I believe it's getting worse according to the numbers. So in my opinion, I believe this is beyond our goals, our imagination. El Chapo is like a trophy and nothing else.
We're speaking with Miguel Angel Vega and Keegan Hamilton. They are co-hosts of the new podcast, Chapo Kingpin on Trial. So let's talk about the trial part, the Vice News' new podcast that drops tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
All right. The trial's made a lot of news just in the past couple of days because it's supposed to happen next month. There was this moment of this idea that the press was going to taint the jury pool.
Yeah.
What was that in the voir dire?
Intriguingly, the judge federal prosecutors in a filing to the judge cited our podcast as something that could potentially taint the jury pool if the trial was delayed, as Chapo's attorneys were asking. Basically just saying that there's so much media frenzy around this case that the New Yorkers will have heard about it and come in with some sort of preconceived notion that Chapo was guilty or that the drug war is futile and he shouldn't be convicted, which, you know, they need a jury to come in and just judge on the evidence and the mm-hmm. evidence alone. Now the trial is starting as planned. That's sort of a moot issue. But they are still going to have to weed out people based on what their knowledge of El Chapo is. And certainly it's going to be hard to find somebody who has no idea already in their head about who this guy is and whether or not he's guilty.
Yeah, something I thought was interesting is one of the arguments was that the jury, potential jury pool, will know that journalists are watching them.
Mm-hmm.
And might reveal what they had to say. I found that interesting. And I wonder if they were trying to sort of put the specter of danger in the air.
I mean, the specter of danger is real for these people. I mean, mm-hmm. the jury will be anonymous. They'll be partially sequestered. Well, they'll be escorted to the court every day. And the outcome was that the judge said only five members of the media will be allowed in the courtroom during jury selection to try to minimize that view in the eyes of potential jurors. And it was also that they didn't, when you are in a jury selection process like that, they're going to ask you personal questions.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want people to self-censor based on the idea that what they say is immediately going to get blasted out by the national and international media.
Should we expect there to be a lot of traffic in New York when this happens?
So that was actually something that was raised a couple months ago because El Chapo has been being held at the MCC, the Metropolitan Correctional Center, which is just up the street from us here. Sort of by City Hall on Pearl Street. So when he had to go to court every day, they would shut down the Brooklyn Bridge in the morning and in the afternoon when he was transported back and forth. They've made some special accommodation. They haven't said exactly what it is. So he will be held somewhere in Brooklyn for the duration of the trial. So the Brooklyn Bridge traffic shouldn't be an issue.
This is going to be a big deal.
It's certainly, the world is watching.
All right, tell folks when and how they can listen to the podcast.
So tomorrow, episode one premieres. It's available on Spotify. The first few episodes will also be available on iTunes and wherever else you get your podcasts.
And then it'll be released weekly from there on?
Weekly after that.
How long? How many?
8 episodes going through mid-December.
All right. Keegan Hamilton, congratulations on the podcast. I got to hear the first two. It's really good.
Thank you.
Really, really good. Miguel Angel Vega, thank you so much for calling in.
Pleasure.
You are listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Stay with us. We'll be right back after the news.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.